from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. California Governor Jerry Brown unveiled a $190 billion state budget proposal yesterday, and big items include education, infrastructure, and a big rainy day fund to prepare for the next recession.
The next governor is going to be on the cliff, and that big red line, that's what I've had. What's out there is darkness, uncertainty, decline, and recession. So good luck, baby.
Coming up on Forum, we'll talk with KQED Scott Schaefer and Marisa Lagos about the budget, the San Francisco mayor's race, and their new radio show and podcast, Political Breakdown. It's all coming up next after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Governor Jerry Brown emphasized investing in transportation, education, and growing the state's rainy day fund as part of his new $190 billion budget proposal released just yesterday. In this hour, we're going to talk about the state budget, Congressman Darrell Issa's decision to not seek re-election, and San Francisco's mayor race with KQED Scott Schaefer and Marisa Lagos. We'll also talk to them about the launch of their own new radio show and podcast, Political Breakdown, which explores politics from a California perspective. But first, we want to get details on the budget with Sacramento politics and government reporter Katie Orr. Katie, good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Well, let's talk about the budget. I mentioned the rainy day fund. We got up to that 10% that Proposition 2 established back in 2014. We've got more money for education, more money indeed for lots of things, including some things that many people are very concerned about. Give us a general overview, if you could.
Sure. As you mentioned, the rainy day fund is really one of the big winners in the governor's budget proposal. His administration is projecting that the state will have about a $6 billion surplus in the coming fiscal year. And Brown is proposing putting mostly all of that into budget reserve funds, including the rainy day fund. He's also looking to increase funding for local schools, K through 12, his school funding formula. He proposes fully funding that 2 years early, and he is allocating more than $4 billion for transportation infrastructure, with about half of that going to fixing roads, bridges, and highways throughout the state.
And more for health care.
Yes, he is allocating more for health care, and that is one of the big unknowns in California right now, because a lot of that depends on the federal government. And of course, as we know, Republicans have been trying to overturn the Affordable Care Act. We have no idea how that will play out eventually. And the state here, we are seeing several efforts to expand health care to the uninsured, expand Medi-Cal. Yesterday, the governor was saying that those are some things that we have to look at, but there is a lot of federal uncertainty on that level.
And we're pretty much continuing his efforts to do something about climate change. Cap and trade will continue.
Yeah, he is going to put $1.25 billion in cap and trade funds available to appropriate in the coming year. This is money that has been debated and fought over in the legislature because there are a lot of places that it can go. And we should say that this is just the governor's proposal. Of course, over the next few months, the legislature will work with him to come up with a final budget in June.
Well, what do you see as impediments there, if anything, or obstacles? I mean, it is a Democratic legislature.
Sure. I mean, I think it's the same issue that frankly comes up a lot with Governor Jerry Brown, in that he wants to put money into the reserves. As we heard in the clip in the top of the show, he's constantly warning of an impending recession, which hasn't struck during his most recent terms in office, but inevitably will strike again. And then you have to balance that with Democrats who say, of course, we want to save for a rainy day as well. However, there are services that we would like to see funded in the state, and perhaps not all of that surplus should go into the reserve fund. Perhaps we can use some of that to bolster some of these other programs. On the other side, as you mentioned, Republicans don't really have as much say in the budget process since they don't control any of the legislature. But they are saying they would like to see the state pay down more of its long-term debts.
Katie Orr is with us from the state capitol. She's Sacramento politics and government reporter for KQED News. And yesterday was not only the unveiling of the budget, and we'll continue to monitor this and watch as it unfolds with the legislature, but there were hearings on sexual harassment. Can you give us an update on that, Katie?
You know, actually, Michael, those hearings are today, and this is something that is highly anticipated in the legislature. The Assembly, of course, had a hearing several weeks ago before Christmas looking at their sexual harassment policies. Today, the Senate will hold one, and people are hopeful that this will make for some tangible changes in the Capitol that has struggled with the sexual harassment scandal for the last several months.
Yeah, I was anticipating it today, but I mean yesterday, but it's going to unfold today. Any expectations there?
I think we're going to I think people are hoping that we'll get a breakdown of, you know, how the Senate handles these things. This is about looking at legal issues surrounding sexual harassment, so I don't know if it'll delve exclusively into the policies of the Senate. But again, I think you're going to see a lot of testimony. You're going to see a lot of emotion. This is something that women in particular here in the Capitol are really fired up about and is not something that they are going to let go easily without, I think, some substantial changes.
Talking about California politics, and Katie Orr joining us again from Sacramento. Katie, thank you so much. Good to have you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And now we have Marisa Lagos with us in studio, who's a reporter with KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Good morning, Marisa.
Morning, Michael.
And we'll say good morning to Scott Schaefer, senior editor for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Good morning, Scott.
Hey, Michael.
Glad to have you both here. Congratulations, because there's going to be a political breakdown show with you two doing your excellent analysis beginning this Thursday at 6:30. We're very excited about this here at KQED.
So are we.
Yeah, we're hoping we don't have a breakdown between now and then.
I must be having a breakdown Thursday. That's tonight,
that's
by the
right.
way. And it begins, actually, with an interview of Governor Brown. Scott, you asked him, among other things, about the current vacancy on the state Supreme Court and asked what lessons he learned from the voters recalling Chief Justice Rose Byrd and two of the other appointees back in 1986. Let's hear what he said.
The court is a conservative institution. It's not your dynamic change agent. It's the preserver of our constitutional and legal system. So you can't expect instant or radical changes by the appointment of different judges. So I have more respect for the slow-moving character of what the court is and what the court has to be.
Now, I wanted our listeners to hear that because, of course, it's important who's going to be replaced and how that's going to proceed in the judiciary. But he also made some comments to you about the difference between what goes on in the legislature, and that's pretty important now, particularly in light of his budget proposal.
Yeah, I mean, this is that cut about from Jerry Brown talking about, what he learned from the Rose Byrd episode back in the 1980s when he appointed the first female justice with not very much experience on the bench. And I think that was Jerry Brown 1.0, and now we have Jerry Brown 2.0 in the final year of a two-year term, and he's much more reflective. And I think there have been a lot of changes in the way the legislature operates. For example, the year he got elected in 2010, the voters also passed a measure, Prop 25, that allows Democrats to pass a budget with a simple majority. That vastly changed the relationship within the legislature, but also between the legislature and the governor. So there are a lot of changes. And I think, Jerry Brown is widely regarded often as the smartest guy in the room and the one who knows California government and also how to cut a deal better than almost anyone. And that's going to be gone after, in a year. And we're going to see how things change when he's no longer there.
We're going on the cliff, he's telling us. But
There's always a cliff.
Marisa, how do you read, what kind of problems he might have getting the budget through the way he's proposed it?
There'll be pushback. But this legislature has been very deferential to Jerry Brown, both on legislation and in the budget. I mean, there will be things that they'll fight for and he'll, throw up his hand and say you're all being crazy, and then he'll agree to some of it. It's kind of the dance we've seen the last 8 years, which again is so, or rather seven, which is so different than what it looked like, say, when I got to Sacramento a few years before Jerry Brown was elected and Schwarzenegger was the governor. We still needed a two-thirds vote, so Republicans were very much in play. We had huge deficits. This was was during, you know, the big sort of financial meltdown and the mortgage meltdown. And a lot of, you know, even though I think in hindsight there were actually some really good things Schwarzenegger did, a lot of anger at him from both sides of the aisle. I was just thinking, hearing Scott talk, how it's interesting because, you know, we talk a lot these days about political discourse and how it's sort of devolved in recent years. And in a way, it's Jerry Brown kind of has gone, as always, against the tide. You know, Jerry Brown 1.0 was more brash and more sort of, I think, partisan in some ways. I think this time around, he's a lot more thoughtful. And you hear that when he thinks about, you know, appointing a Supreme Court justice. Most politicians of all stripes, I think, are really want to think about leaving, you know, their liberal or conservative bent on the court, whatever that court may be. And if you look at Trump and the promises he made about the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, Jerry Brown was talking yesterday to us about like this need for balance and not wanting to sort of skew the court too much one way or the other. Now, you know, he's a Democrat. Let's be clear. He's a liberal Democrat. But he, I think, you know, it's not just for him about where they stand politically, and this, I think, extends beyond the court. It's about sort of thoughtfulness and thinking about the broader picture and what that means for California.
And I think also that he, you know, like Marisa said, you know, a lot of politicians would look to various constituencies and like, which constituency do I need to please with my next appointment to the state Supreme Court? You know, and Jerry Brown has already appointed an African-American, a Latino, Asian-American. So now this is his fourth appointment out of seven. So his next appointment is going to give him a majority of appointees. And, you know, as Marisa said, just listening to him yesterday, he's really thinking about what does the court need. I'm not sure exactly what he means by that. But for example, there's no Southern California justice right now on the state Supreme Court. Does the court need that? Or does it, what, you know, what perspective is not heard right now within the among those seven justices? And so it's just interesting to hear his thought process.
There's no religious breakdown like there is in the federal court between Catholics and Jews, is there?
I don't know what the religious breakdown is.
That's an interesting question. I think you may be more likely to get an atheist on the Supreme Court in California.
Well, no, but we're going to talk about politics more than religion here. In fact, political breakdown is being inaugurated tonight, and I really want to get listeners advised as to what they can expect. They can expect, first of all, an interview with Jerry Brown tonight.
Yeah, you know, I think the reason this show has happened, and first of all, thanks to KQED for giving us the support and the room and the resources to do this program. You know, after Trump got elected, everything changed and people have become so engaged in a different way than they were during the presidential election. And we've seen that, for example, in the things that we post online, what goes viral, what gets a lot of traffic. You know, it's kind of an instant feedback. And the appetite for politics is just extraordinary. I mean, just this past week, we had, you know, the DACA decision with a federal judge in San Francisco, the mayor's race filing deadline, the budget. There's a sexual harassment hearing. You know, there's just, you know, two retirements in Congress from California. There's so much going on.
Much that we need to talk about. Right. Yeah, this morning, in fact, you know, I was struck when you were talking about that. I saw online the promotion for the program, and it said, it's going to concentrate on California politics, and we're going to do analysis in this left-leaning state. And it is a left-leaning state. And so there's a lot of welcome for, frankly, a lot of anti-Trump stuff. I mean, you're good journalists, try to do as fair balanced as you can and everything. But you really feel this groundswell a lot in the criticism of the national and what's going on from Washington itself. But you're concentrating on California, and that's certainly important to our listeners, as it is for them to hear. In fact, let's talk with you, Marissa, about the governor's race. I'm just interested in the way it's shaping up for you, especially what distinguishes these candidates. Now, I looked at a UC Berkeley poll, and I was a little bit astonished because, not to my surprise, Gavin Newsom was in the lead, and Gavin Newsom has the most resources behind him. But who came out second? John Cox, a businessman and Republican, had like 11%. It's true that it was only a percent above Villarosa, the former mayor of Los Angeles, had. But the reality is that there's a real race going on here, and I don't want to talk about it so much as a horse race. I want to talk about, for listeners' sake, what distinguishes these candidates now, as you see it.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting. You know, we have this top two primary system in California, and so I think in a lot of ways, both Villaraigosa and Newsom, who are seen as the Democratic frontrunners in a deeply blue state, as you just mentioned, are really both hoping to, you know, to get through this June primary and get on the November ballot. But as you mentioned, we do have John Cox, who is a very wealthy businessman, Republican, is putting some of his own money into this race. You know,
I was thinking it's going to be like Kamala Harris and Loretta Sanchez, but not necessarily.
It could be. And I think at this
Two Democrats.
Right. I think at this point, the question for Republicans is whether, and I mean, it's you know, mid-January already, which is crazy. But, you know, whether they can coalesce behind somebody, because while John Cox, I think, polls well now, and, you know, a lot of, sometimes in these early polls, it's just what a letter is next to your name or who have you heard of yet. You know, a lot of voters haven't really made up their minds. But we have seen, you know, we have him in the race. We have Assemblyman Travis Allen, who's very conservative, also a Republican. And then we have Doug Ossie, who entered the race recently. And I think, you know, it stands to reason that given the registration numbers and how many independent voters we have here in California, that unless Republicans can really coalesce behind one candidate in the next 6 months, we may see those Republicans split the vote and end up with two Democrats in December.
But those two Democrats are not going to include Tom Steyer or Jackie Speier.
Yeah, no, that's right. They're not running. But I think one of the things that terrifies Republicans is this notion that we could have in November no Republicans on the ballot. There's no presidential election, so there'll be no one running for that office. And then if you have two Democrats running for left in the top two primary for the governor's race and the Senate race, there's right now no major Republican running for the U.S. Senate against Dianne Feinstein. So you could end up with Kevin DeLeon, the senator from L.A., against Dianne Feinstein. So what's going to bring Republicans out to vote? And so that's terrifying them. And I just want to say one other thing.
I'll tell you something else that's terrifying them. You have Darrell Issa leaving. You have Fullerton Congressman Ed Royce leaving. And in fact, there's been a kind of writing on the wall for many of these Republican candidates. They're talking about something I've never heard before, which is strategic resignation. I mean, it's like dominoes falling almost.
Yeah, it's kind of the burden of incumbency. Yeah. You know, ordinarily incumbency is a huge advantage. I mean, incumbents rarely get defeated when they're running for reelection in for Congress. But, you know, Issa was probably the most vulnerable Republican in California, if not the nation. He barely got reelected last time.
He's also the richest person in Congress.
He is the most wealthy member of Congress.
He's also the head of a committee, too. I mean, chaired a committee, a very important committee.
Yeah, but what's driving so much of this is demographics. I mean, the demographics in his district in San Diego, southern Orange County, and a little bit of Riverside, many more Latinos and Asian Americans, younger voters have been so turned off by the Republican Party. And so in some ways, it's possible that by losing these two incumbents, Ed Royce in Fullerton and Darrell Issa, that the Republicans may have strengthened their hand a little bit, even though the seats will be open, because now it'll be harder for the Democrats to hang Trump and the votes that they've been casting in Congress, you know, things like offshore oil drilling, the tax bill. It's going to be harder to hang those around Republicans' necks. Not that they can't, but, you know, it won't be the incumbents who will be under attack. It'll be these other Republicans.
Correct me if I'm wrong here, Scott, but I think this is the most open seat thing we've seen since 1994.
It indicates that they see a wave coming, and certainly, they're all indications of that. What we saw in Virginia in particular, but Alabama was kind of a one-off. I'm not sure what we really take away from that. But certainly, enthusiasm and turnout, that's what elections are won and lost by.
Well, Marissa, how do you think this is going to affect the midterm election? And you got 24 needed, really, to change the House of Representatives.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in California, you know, we've seen the list of targeted seats grow slightly. And this certainly, I think, really energizes some of the Democrats who are going after them. I mean, it's going to be interesting. In the ISA race, for example, you already had at least two and probably more Democrats who are raising money. Doug Applegate, who ran against him and barely lost last time on a pretty shoestring campaign the first time around. He's a former colonel. He's, you know, kind of trying to get that like veteran vote, but is pretty progressive. You have Mike Levin, who's
he's a real estate investor. He's got a lot of money.
He's got money. He's pretty young, pretty connected. So, you know, it's going to be fascinating to see how ISA's departure, because for them currently and in, you know, until yesterday, all of their attention was on Issa, and what they wanted to do was keep him out of, you know, get him rid for the primary, and then they could go after each other. With the fact that this is open, how many Republicans jump in? Do the Democrats start muddying each other up? You know, there's a lot of open questions. It does get interesting. I do think, to Scott's point about voter turnout, one thing I think Republicans will be looking to is initiatives, and whether things like the potential repeal of the gas tax that Jerry Brown is really relying on in this budget to fund road repairs, whether an initiative that's being rolled out today, ironically, in part by a Democratic assemblyman, to repeal some of the criminal justice reforms that Brown and others have championed, you know, those could be some of those issues that they hope really drive GOP voters to the polls. But again, the registration numbers aren't in their favor in California. And I think, you know, The big question to me in the mayor, in the governor's race, and in a lot of these races is something that we've been talking about for like my entire lifetime in California, which is Latino turnout. And there's this really big hope among the Kevin DeLeons, who's challenging Dianne Feinstein, the Antonio Villaraigosas. You know, we have a number of other Latinos on the statewide ballot running for statewide offices. That this will finally be the year that, really Latinos turn out. And I think that there's a lot of skepticism for good reason. And then there's a lot of hope. I was just having lunch this week with Villaraigosa's campaign consultant, and he was saying, look, you know, millennial Latinos are a different, you know, sort of group and a different demographic than their parents were. And we think that now that they're in their 30s. So we'll see. But, you know, I mean, we have seen a lot of excitement. And you mentioned Virginia, Scott. We talked about Alabama. You know, I think if Democrats can get out and turn out voters in a way that the it could change the calculation.
One sort of wild
Scott,
card.
Excuse me. Let me just remind listeners, we're talking about California politics with KQED's Marisa Lagos and Scott Schaefer and their new radio show and podcast Political Breakdown, which explores politics from a California perspective, launches tonight on KQED at 6:30. And by the way, you can launch some involvement in this program. Let me tell you how you can join us if you have thoughts or comments, questions about California politics, about the budget, about anything that we're talking about, the governor's race, or we're going to talk about the mayor's race as well. Whatever's on your mind, we welcome your involvement in the program. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786. You can join us live at 866-733-6786. You can also email any questions or comments you might have, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post questions or comments there, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's at KQED Forum. Scott, Chief.
Yeah, I was just going to pick up on Marisa's question or point about Latino turnout in the midterms. I mean, you know, one wild card, I think, is that we've got now a big discussion in Washington about DACA, whether or not those protections for those young folks who came here without documents when they were kids, you know, is their issue going to be resolved by an act of Congress? Will there be comprehensive immigration reform? What will that look like? And if that happens, and there is some incentive on both sides of the aisle to get that done, what will that do to Latino turnout? Will they feel like, okay, that issue's off the table, and maybe they don't feel as motivated to go out to the polls? So, you know, there are a lot of things in play right now as we, you know, still are 5 months away from the election.
Of course, even if they do that, you still have, you know, the Trump administration removing protection for Salvadorans and Haitians. And other, I mean, there's so many things. And as we know, and part of the reason we're launching this show is that things move so fast now. I mean, Michael, it's like every week your political Monday, you know, roundtable is a completely different set of subjects because there's so much happening. And I do want to say back to the political breakdown. You know, one thing we really want to do is be telling the story about politics, not just in California, but nationally, but from a California perspective, because we think that there is such a unique perspective here. And, you know, I've been joking this year that for most of my life as a political reporter, all politics are local and you have to focus so much on what's happening here. And under Trump, it's like all politics are national. And suddenly people who never paid attention to D.C. want to talk about it at, you know,
when you think how different the conversation would be if Hillary Clinton had won. You know, we would be.
I do think about
the
that.
The focus would be very different.
But also, if you're a taxpayer, you think about how much this tax bill may affect you and many other things that are coming out of, especially environmental things like offshore drilling and everything affecting us. Let me again invite you to join us. If you have questions or comments about the political landscape, this is a good time to bring them forward and join our discussion. You can do that toll free at 866-733-6786 or by emailing us forum@kqed.org. And we'll return. We'll also talk about the mayor's race. Stay tuned for that. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour about California politics with KQED's Scott Schaefer and Marisa Lagos. Their new radio show and podcast, Political Breakdown, explores politics from a California perspective. It launches tonight on KQED, and they have an interview with the governor, Jerry Brown. In fact, Marisa asked Jerry Brown, and you'll hear this tonight, you can hear it here, a little exclusive, about what's behind the evolution and the way he thinks about criminal justice.
The world is so much different. When Reagan and I were governor, the maximum number of people in prison was 29,000-30,000. That was the maximum. And now, without any real increase in the crime rate, or even the actual number of crimes, in many ways they've gone down, the incarceration rate has gone up 500%.
Marisa?
Yeah, I mean, this is something I've talked to Jerry Brown about over the last 7 years quite a bit. And I mean, you know, I think you have to put this in context. He came in facing this federal court order. The prisons were just grossly overcrowded. A federal court basically said that a person a day was dying because of the inadequate medical care that was due to that overcrowding. And so it's really interesting to me. You know, Jerry Brown oversaw the changing of the way we approach criminal justice during his first two terms. He signed a law that took away determinate sentencing and gave a lot more power to the parole board and to prosecutors and judges to give these sort of sentences that you know, seem to never end and never end. And so when he came back, he had to deal with that. And we've seen him institute laws that took a lot of more low-level offenders out of state prison and instead put them in local jails. We saw him last year push this ballot measure that really changed the parole process and sort of inched it back towards where it was 30, 40 years ago. And I was interested in asking him about like what made him think about that, because there's a lot, you know, his father was a prosecutor and then the attorney general. He was the attorney general. He's got a very close relationship with a lot of people in law enforcement. And I think it's been really interesting to see him evolve, you know, especially this late in his life on something so fundamental. And really, I would say brought California along with him on that. We've seen voters really change the way they approach this from, you know, the harsh sort of draconian three strikes and other laws of the 90s to the last, you know, 7 years or so. We've embraced just the slew of reforms. And I think it'll be interesting in his final year to see how he approaches that. And we haven't even talked about the fact that he still has, what, $25 million in the bank. And so it's entirely
political campaign money.
Account, yeah. So, you know, whether or not he decides to back anything or fight anything that's on the ballot next year, or what, you know, what he decides to do with that money and if it'll relate to criminal justice, because that and climate change have, I would say, really been the big sort of policy issues of his last
and,
two
you know,
terms.
He came into office with this court mandate, that, you know, under federal court order to reduce overcrowding in the prison. So he had a good excuse, if you will, to begin letting more people out of prison. But he's also done it in a very comprehensive way. I mean, he, more than any other governor, has allowed lifers, you know, people serving 25 to life with the possibility of parole, to get out of prison. I mean, hundreds, thousands of lifers are now on the streets. They've been paroled. And we talked with him yesterday about how Gray Davis, I think, in his entire time in office, allowed only, I think, 14 people, all women, to be paroled. He reversed the parole board's decisions time and time and time again. Schwarzenegger allowed a few more people to get out. But Jerry Brown has really embraced this idea of second chances for people who have served their time. And, you know, it's playing out in some ways in an experiment, but people seem to have embraced it. There will be some things on the ballot potentially to kind of like, you know, it's kind of bring some of it back, make it a little more tougher on crime than it is now under Prop 47 and Prop 57. But, you know, clearly there has been a groundswell change in how criminal justice is approached in California, and it's really been led by Jerry Brown.
Well, a couple of other things that have to do with Jerry Brown's leadership. I'm just looking at some comments here from listeners. Stephen tweets, poverty is deep and real across California. Governor Brown again refuses to restore cuts to seniors and people with disabilities. No funding for 1.3 million Californians on supplementary security income, even as the rainy day fund fills up while the state has the highest poverty rate in the nation.
Yeah,
it's true. But, you know, at the same time, we have 13.5 million Californians on Medi-Cal. That's a huge number. I mean, health and human services is by far the biggest part of our budget. And I think, you know, Marisa, I'm not sure how you would describe it, but I think, you know, the governor has always been cautious, you know, and not wanting to overextend, because if, you know, we have expanded more than any other state Medi-Cal for under the Affordable Care Act. We're extending it to undocumented immigrants, in some cases, children. And so when the economy turns down, you know, you're going to see potentially enormous cuts in those things. And I think he's looking at it in a, like, sort of paddle twice on the left, twice on the right to kind of steer a middle course.
And he said yesterday, I mean, when he was asked this in the press conference and in our conversation, I mean, his basic response to a comment like that is that, you know, if we expand those programs at the expense of the rainy day fund, they're just going to get cut back further during the next recession. And he has warned that, you know, the night is dark and deep to
well, curb. Let me read another comment, get your response to this, Marisa, and then I want to get to some callers and we're going to get to the mayor's race in San Francisco. But David writes, California State University System is the largest four-year public university system in the U.S. The CSU system needs more support to replace aging infrastructure. Many buildings were built in the 1950s and are outdated and unsafe.
Yeah, I mean, I think Brown would respond the same to all of this, which is there's only so much money to go around, and I think we're doing a good job sort of deciding where to put it. You know, we asked him, though, about this deep issue of poverty and inequality, and, you know, he talked about the fact that he feels like this is not just a California issue. It's clearly, you know, not just a national issue, an international one. And I do think it's really one of the sort of big, you know, sort of unsolvable things that Jerry Brown has not been able to tackle. I think some of these issues, he's done a really good job of sort of righting the ship in California. But we have seen, you know, housing prices continue to explode. The rich get richer and the poor, the group of poor and lower middle class grow. And, you know, I think these are things that the next governor is going to really have to grapple with. And again, not just in California, but nationally.
And I would add that, the governor pointed out yesterday, the Department of Finance, that under Jerry Brown, the last 7 years, CSU has gotten an additional $1.6 billion in funding. Now, of course, some of that was after the trough of the cuts and the Great Recession. But, you know, there's a lot to spend money on. In California, it's got to be spread around.
Let me get some callers on her. We will talk about the San Francisco mayor's race, but let's hear first from you. Colin, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
With respect to extending Medi-Cal to the undocumented, I understand that one of the priorities for the Democrats has been to extend Medi-Cal to all undocumented residents, not just children. Now, given that there has been the state and local tax deduction curtailed under the federal tax bill that was just passed, are the Democrats going to revisit some of these spending plans?
Asking for some speculation. I mean, Marisa, go ahead.
I would guess that if you asked the leadership or Governor Brown about that, they would say those are two separate issues. And, you know, the bottom line is, we are going to feel it as individuals, but the state's taxes aren't automatically going to be impacted by the Republican plan. It's just we won't be able to write them off, so we might be paying more as individuals. I know that there is a measure by Kevin DeLeon that is attempting to sort of create some sort of workaround to that to basically make it so that your taxes would be a charitable
contribution. We actually interviewed him on this.
Yeah, and we'll see if that both survives legislatively and legally. I think there's a lot of open questions about whether that's possible. But, you know, I think more broadly that in California, the leadership here, the Democrats, are not trying to see this as an either or, and they are not going to suddenly start rolling back programs that they've worked hard to expand.
They're not going to lower taxes.
No.
No, and I think one thing that
or make up for the deductions gone by lowering taxes.
I think
that
thing,
was what he was trying to ask, I think, yeah.
One thing I think the governor is very proud of, and rightfully so, is that whoever becomes governor next year is going to have about a $13.5 billion piggy bank, as he called it yesterday, with the rainy day fund. And that is a lot better situation than he inherited when he became governor. Of course, the circumstances were different. The economy was in a trough when Jerry Brown's always good to buy low and sell high. But eventually that recession that the governor's been warning about for 4 or 5 years is going to happen. And so if you expand these programs now when times are good, you know, the tide goes out and then, you know, you're left holding the bag and having to cut a whole bunch of things.
We'll take some more of your calls. We'll go next to you. Ellen, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I had a question for Scott Schaefer. If I understood your comment, you were saying that perhaps if some version of the DREAM Act were passed, that might depress the immigrant vote. And I'm thinking it might do just the opposite, since it would leave so many people, so many immigrants behind. So could you explain that a bit?
Sure. What I was saying was that if Congress does come up with some sort of a comprehensive solution to immigration reform that would include more border security, as President Trump is calling for, that it could lessen the anger and the impetus to get out and vote. I mean, already historically in midterm elections, Latinos vote at lower rates, younger voters, low-income voters generally. And so I'm just saying, if one of the motivations to get out and vote is removed, you could lessen the incentive, reduce the turnout. But as you said, there are so many issues. I mean, just yesterday in the Bay Area, there were ICE raids at 7-Eleven stores looking for workers who were undocumented. I mean, you know, DACA and some of these issues are just one piece of a larger, very large issue that people feel very personally about. And it may take more than passing a fix to DACA to resolve those feelings. But I'm just saying, there, you know, elections, there's a lot of pieces to the puzzle, and you don't know how they're all going to come together come election time.
Well, let me thank Ellen for her call. Go ahead, Ellen. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say we are seeing people become citizens in record numbers, if I'm not mistaken. I think part of that is they're motivated to be able to have a voice and vote.
Absolutely. I have a friend today who is becoming a citizen, actually having a naturalization ceremony. So people are very motivated, in part because they're scared.
And I thank Ellen for the call. What about all these undocumented workers, undocumented citizens, not citizens, who are supposedly voting illegally, according to the Trump administration? There was a whole thorough investigation that somehow never got off its heels.
Yeah, that's just one of those charges that won't die, but there's very little data to support it.
Another caller from Belmont, Charles, joins us. Want to talk about the ISA race. Go ahead, Charles.
I had a question and a comment on the California 49th district race. I think, first of all, that Mike Levin is actually an environmental attorney.
Thank you. Yes, I meant to say that. Yes, he is.
And Mike's a great guy. I think he actually gets a ton of credit for ISA's retirement from his spreading on social media of the picture and story of ISA hiding from his constituents on the top of his campaign offices to the type of campaign he's run. And my question for you is, what do you think ISA's departure does to that race in terms of which Democrats will rise to the top down there?
Well, it removes the focal point of the attacks. I mean, already we've been beginning to see Levin and Doug Applegate kind of turn on each other, thinking that it was going to be in the runoff in November, it was going to be ISA and one of them. Now with ISA gone, it changes the dynamic.
We've got Rocky Chavez.
It's going to be a battle royal, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you got, but it does change the dynamic because it removes, like, Rocky Chavez, who was a relatively moderate Republican assemblyman from San Diego, has jumped in. There will be others, no doubt, who jump in as well.
Carl DeMaio, very well-known, very conservative former San Diego councilman.
So it just removes some of the focus on Trump, I think, and how that ultimately affects, I think it increases the chance that you're going to have a Republican and a Democrat, and the focus is going to be more about what they want to do and less about what
but
Trump is.
But as I recall, ISA only won by about 0.5%, and he was really changing his rhetoric, changing his attitude.
Yeah, he sent out a brochure just before the election in 2016, a picture of him and Barack Obama talking about how they work together, which is really kind of laughable, given that he had been one of Obama's harshest critics.
Given the fact that he ran those papers over to the White House very quickly.
Given the fact that we have Chavez already jumped in, at least three other Republicans of varying sort of levels of conservatism eyeing this race, It could well be that this is good for any Republican because they're not an incumbent and they're not that close to Trump. But it also could turn into what I was talking about in the governor's race, where you have such close registration numbers here that this could provide an opening for the left, because you might have some of these Republicans really split the vote. And, I think it's really wide open at this point. And I'm sure that for Applegate and Levin, it really changes a lot of their calculations.
Well, and I think like in the Ed Royce seat in Orange County, too, you have at least five or six serious Democrats. It'll be interesting to see if the Democratic Party tries to get a couple of them out, the ones who maybe have raised less money or have less chance, just so that they reduce the chance of having two Republicans in the runoff.
Well, I said I wanted to talk about the San Francisco mayor's race. I want to find out from both of you, either of you, really what distinguishes those candidates. But first, can we get back to a question I raised earlier? What distinguishes the gubernatorial candidates? I mean, for example, in the Democratic side, pretty much you hear the debate with Delaine Easton and the other who have declared their candidacy, Villagrosa, very similar on almost everything down the line. Newsom? Yeah.
Well, I will answer that, but I think one of the things Marisa and I want to do with Political Breakdown, the new show that debuts tonight at 6:30, please read my book, there are nuanced differences among these folks, especially among the Democrats, about what they support, whether it's single payer or high speed rail. But, ultimately, politics comes down to what kind of people are they? What kind of values are they? What kind of leadership skills do they have? How do they forge coalitions? And, I think one of the things we want to do on Political Breakdown, as we did with Governor Brown when we talked to him yesterday, is find out what motivates them. What kind of people are they? How did they come to the positions that they have arrived at? Now, to your question, I mean, both Villaraigosa and Newsom have been big city mayors. Newsom has championed issues like gun control and marijuana legalization, probably best known for gay marriage in San Francisco, being an early advocate for which he paid a political price early on. You know, and then you've got Delaney's and John Chung, who's kind of the state treasurer, who's running as a more moderate, sort of a, more in the Jerry Brown mold in a way, someone who's going to be maybe a better steward
finance
of finances. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I think that the Republicans are a little less clear just because we don't know them as well. But I think obviously they're going to be against higher taxes and they want lower spending and all those kinds of things. The thing is, and this is somewhat true in San Francisco's mayor's race as well, you know, the distinctions are maybe not as great as they would be, say, at a presidential level where you have two parties standing for very different, totally different things.
But I noticed just yesterday, Marisa Jane Kim came out with a talk about $800,000 for street cleaning. I mean, taking positions like that can actually help launch. I wonder about how you see the distinctions, though, between those candidates, especially now that we have Angela Alioto in. And I'm wondering, where is her constituency? You can almost identify constituencies for Jane Kim, for Mark Leno, certainly for those who have thrown their hat in the ring. And there are some people who are actually not on, shall we say, most people's radar who are in this race as well. I don't want to forget them. I want to bring them into this as well. But certainly London Breed, who's now in a pretty good position. But you've got Ellen Lee Chow, who's a volunteer social worker, Amy Farrah Weiss, who is a homeless community organizer. We heard that title before, I think. And Richie Greenberg, who's a business guy. And then Michelle Bravo, who somehow is not identified in the contact list. So I just want to make sure I named all eight of them. There are eight in it.
Ellen Lee Zhao is the other. She's been an organizer, too.
But we got eight candidates still, don't we?
Yeah. So, you know, I would say, Not to underplay the other ones, but the most well-known, as you mentioned, are former state senator, assemblyman, and supervisor Mark Leno, current acting mayor and board of supervisors president London Breed, and current supervisor Jane Kim. And I think, you know, this sets up a really interesting field. It's smaller, quite frankly, than I think we would have seen in 2019 in terms of really, like, you know, sort of typical institutional candidates. So we have, you know, London Breed, who is being supported really by, I would say, a lot of the folks who have helped run the city for the last three decades. You have Willie Brown really championing her, a lot of support from a lot of people behind the scenes who have been close to people like Gavin Newsom and Kamala Harris and, you know, the sort
Ron
of
Conway.
Ron Conway, the sort of institutional city leaders. And so I think that while, you know, London is going to talk a lot about her personal story growing up in the projects here and being an
American woman. Her narrative has been a big part of her campaign.
That's going to be a big part. But I think for her opponents, what they're going to say is, look, you know, she's really part of this institution that has run the city for a long time. And if you are not happy with that, then we want you to look at us. And so I think the question then becomes, you know, Jane Kim is by far the most progressive lefty supervisor in the race. Where does Mark Leno fit into that? And what do London Breed and Jane Kim do about him? I mean, are they going to spend all their time attacking each other and ignoring Leno?
He has the most money, right?
He has the most money because he's been fundraising for a while. And he's interesting because he is, you know, I think if you were to leave California particularly, but even San Francisco, he is a bleeding heart liberal. But he's a pragmatic guy. He really worked hard in Sacramento to build relationships with business communities. And he was interesting for me to watch. You know, he was very liberal, for example, on criminal justice, but also forged some alliances with Republicans. And so I think I would put him sort of between them. But I think depending on the issue and the day, it's going to really be fascinating. And I do think that, you know, what we see here is almost like a rematch in some ways, not in terms of the candidates, but of the players of, you know, Matt Gonzalez and Gavin Newsom so many years ago.
Well, and let's not forget, too, that this will be decided ultimately by ranked choice voting. And so what really is going to matter in the end is who voters have as their second and third choice. And, you know, we'll see how that plays out.
Well, it's coming up June.
But right? You have large constituencies that aren't, you know, easily represented. I mean, the whole west side of San Francisco, you would say, like, who, you know, how are they going to come down in this? Chinatown and the Asian American community, although Jane Kim is Korean American, you know, if David Chu, the assemblyman, for example, had run. Or Carmen Chu, the city assessor. I mean, you might have had a more natural link to Chinatown. So I think there's a lot of constituencies that are up for grabs. And Mark Leno, although he's openly gay, you know, the other candidates have some support in the LGBT community as well. So it's very much wide open right now, very much.
Let's get open to another caller. Guillermo joins us next. Guillermo, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for taking my phone call. So you earlier were talking about the potential of the Democrats pick it up in other seats on Orange County and other areas, and how the race for the governor is looking forward to in the future. My question is, have you do any analysis or you have any information about a third party jump into the elections in California and screwed up the whole entire election process, where it will benefit other candidates, whether it's the Republicans or the Democrats, by having a third party jumping and say, oh, we're going to run for California governor seats, or anyone from outside of the state will come up and trying to support certain candidates. And by that I mean, you know, we'll see this happen during the election.
Thank you for that, Guillermo.
One of the real impacts, one of the big impacts of the top two primary system in California is that it has really minimized and diminished the role of third parties, Green Party, Libertarians, and so on. I mean, it's almost impossible now for those parties, because of their lack of resources, their lack of name ID, to make it into the final two, whether it's in a congressional race or a gubernatorial race. I mean,
that even includes the Libertarians, really.
Yeah, it really totally does. So it's, you know, there's always this notion, especially at the presidential level, like, is it time for a third party, like a Michael Bloomberg, who looked at that, for example. It's easier said than done, and there's a reason that it really doesn't happen very
often. Also, because of this open primary system, we don't have these early endorsements a lot of times in these party races. And so you have, in a way, it's almost like it doesn't matter as much from a, you know, institutional support way who's in the race, because you don't have the Democratic Party throwing all their money and support behind one candidate prior to November. I think that, you know, no, the answer is no, both in California and nationally, because we haven't really seen anybody sort of rise to that challenge and create any sort of institution that I think can really go up against the Democrats and Republicans. But we should note that no party preference independent voters in California are like a quarter of the electorate now. And so I think that that does leave an opening, not necessarily for people who maybe you run as an independent, but also just people who are more independent of the parties, even if they are still within that umbrella.
You know, we keep talking about where constituencies are, and, you know, with third parties, they don't have the constituency. And I always have a question about Angela Alioto, who served on the Board of Supervisors and really led a lot of homelessness attempts to do something very serious and profound about homelessness. And, you know, his father was a former mayor. But where's her constituency? It brings up another big question that a listener wants answered here. How much is gerrymandering still a fact in California, or a factor?
Well, it's not any factor in the mayor's race, of course. I think it's much less. You know, we've seen this issue of extreme political partisan gerrymandering coming up just this week in North Carolina. The U.S. Supreme Court is taking it up. But California, a few years ago, voters gave control over to a citizens commission. And so we don't have those crazy-shaped lines and districts anymore. It's a model that many states have adopted, and you know, some would like to see adopted nationwide, including Barack Obama, you know, who's pushing that idea along with Arnold Schwarzenegger. So, you know, it's much less of a factor in California than it was, you know, say, you know, 10 years ago.
Well, during the Burton hegemony years, let me rephrase them, maybe. Marisa, here's a listener who says, in your opinion, how many of the current Republican-held congressional seats in California will be won by Democrats? Now, it's a little bit crystal ball-gazing, but maybe you can us what your sense is at this time.
Yeah. There's 14 seats. Democrats are targeting 7 of them, or did they increase that to 8?
Yeah, I think they included McClintock,
yeah.
So it's up to 8 now.
And so, you know, I think that it's a long way between now and November. I mean, think back 2 years ago and what if we thought President Trump would be in the Oval Office then. But I, you know, I think that there are a handful where there's a real chance. I'm just seeing news break that ICE is considering running in Duncan Hunter's neighboring congressional district if he decides to retire. So, I mean, look, you know, while I think Democrats are painting a lot of these folks as Trump Republicans and connected, these are all very different districts. If you look at Daryl Issa, wealthy coastal district versus, say, Jeff Denham's Modesto, Central Valley, more rural, they are very different. I think the question is if Democrats can do what they say they're trying to do, which is not just try to tie all these people to Trump and boot them out, but really go into the districts and find out what they need and what kind of candidates they want to support, that you could see a groundswell. But to Scott's earlier points, you know, it always matters who turns out to vote, who's motivated. Are people just, you know, screaming on Facebook about Donald Trump, or are they going to get off their butts in November and go to the polls? And I think it, you know, it's an open question, and these are all very diverse districts, so I'm not really prepared to say that anybody's going to win yet, because we don't even know who's going to be on the ballot in November.
Well, and then also that, you know, the Democrats have to find candidates that resonate with the voters in those districts. I mean, there's a reason people like Jeff Denham in Modesto and David Valadao down in Hanford and Nunes in the Central Valley. There's a reason those folks keep getting reelected. They can speak the language. You know, it's, you can't have someone from the outside, from, say, you know, the coast, move back to their old hometown in the Central Valley and think that it's going to resonate with people.
You'd almost think it was a red state in certain places that you're talking about.
Yeah, it's certainly, you know, California's version of, I mean, there are some very red counties. You know, Trump carried something like 28 counties in California. I mean, many of them are, most of them, all of them really are very sparsely populated. But, you know, there is definitely a constituency for that.
Quick question, seconds left, but Michael wants to know, your guests have any sense of whether Governor Brown, a longtime, lifelong opponent of capital punishment, will grant clemency to any of the 750 men and women on California's death row, largest in the country?
I don't know. There are now about 17 inmates whose legal appeals have been exhausted, and so they are now theoretically eligible to be executed, and with a recent ballot measure, that's supposed to start happening. But it is up to Jerry Brown, really, what the pace of that is going to be. I mean, he's a longtime opponent, as the caller said, and I'd be very surprised if he's going to want his final term in office to include an execution or two under his watch. I think he'll probably do everything he can to avoid that, and it's going to be up to the next governor.
Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you, Scott. Thank you, Marisa. Congratulations on the new show. It's going to be highlighted, and it's going to be inaugurated tonight at 6:30. You can find the podcast on iTunes or wherever you find your podcast. Scott Schaefer and Marisa Lagos beginning a new program. A lot of excitement around that here at KQED. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Our guest next hour will be Daniel Ellsberg, and he has a new book out about nuclear power.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.